All right, let's finish up this chapter, finish up the unit. That way you'll be prepared for the examination. I don't remember whether I've already told you this, but all of the lecture examinations are entirely multiple choice, so they use Scantron forms, which unfortunately nowadays you have to supply. Maricopa used to give them to you, but they're trying to save a few bucks, so it's not a problem financially because they're not expensive, but the problem is there's always a couple people who forget, and I don't have any, so it's important that you remember to get some from the bookstore before showing up. I think they sell them in sixes, packets of six, which is perfect for the term, but in any case, it'll be enough unless you have to lend someone who forgot it that day. Try not to be that person who does forget. You need the 50 question ones, though, the green ones, about this long. They'll know what you need.
What's the name of it?
Scantron forms. We only made it through one slide, so we're up to slide two in this chapter that's about organic compounds. And all of these are organic compounds because they contain carbon and something else, in this case, hydrogen. Notice that every one of these examples, and these are just examples, has carbon and hydrogen and nothing else. No other kind of element in these. So not only are these all organic compounds, which is a huge set, but it's a subset of organic compounds called hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbons contain only carbon and hydrogen, nothing else. And be careful with that term, because later we'll be talking about carbohydrates, which is a similar sounding word, but carbohydrates, as we'll see, contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, whereas hydrocarbons is just carbon and hydrogen. So hydrocarbons are the simplest organic compounds, and the first example here is the simplest possible organic compound, methane, CH4, which you built, I think, with your molecular modeling kits, right? Well, one thing that's important about hydrocarbons is that they make excellent fuels. We'll get into the reasons why this is true later, after the first test. But they contain a lot of chemical energy that can be released if those hydrocarbons are combusted. If they're burned, that releases the energy. And this is exactly what gasoline is. It's a mixture of different hydrocarbons. Contains a lot of energy, and some of that energy goes into propelling the car down the road. Well, that's true also in biology. It's because of this, the carbon-hydrogen bonds, that there is a lot of usable energy that can be released, and we get a lot of energy from the food that we eat because there's a lot of carbon-hydrogen bonds, even if they are not completely hydrocarbon molecules. We'll see what I mean when we get to examples later. But let's go to slide three first and talk more about why carbon is kind of special. We see the four biggies, the four elements that make up the bulk of any given organism in terms of the number of atoms. I showed you that chart in an earlier chapter showing you what a human body is made out of. There's many different elements in you or any given organism, but if you were to count all the atoms, most of those atoms would be either hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, or carbon. The other kinds of elements are in much smaller abundance within the body of an organism. These are the four biggies, and that's why these are the four that you had in your kit when you were building things. But these cartoons represent, the circles of the cartoons represent levels, as we've talked about before. These are shells or levels, right? And the dots are electrons. So this represents the valences. I mean, you can deduce the valencies of these by looking at these. Hydrogen has one valence electron, but its valence is one, right? Because for the particular example of shell one, which is its valence shell, two is full, so it's one away from being full. Well, these others, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon, have
shell 2 as the valence shell.
Oxygen has 6 valence electrons, but it's 2 away from getting full at 8. So its valence is 2. And remember what I said in lab, that means in terms of making molecules, if oxygen is going to be part of a molecule, then that's what it, because it has a valence of 2, is why it always has to be making 2 bonds, whether it's 2 single bonds or 1 double bond, which counts as 2. It's going to form 2 bonds because it gets a credit for an additional electron that's being shared with it for each bond that it forms, and that will bring it to 8. Nitrogen's going to always form 3 bonds because its valence is 3. It's 3 away from being full. And carbon is always going to be making 4 bonds. So the valence of carbon is 4, but in one word we can say that's true by saying that carbon is tetravalent, which simply means having a valence of 4. Tetra means 4. And tetravalence is kind of special because it allows for a lot more versatility with respect to using that atom in a molecule. There's a lot more ways you can combine things with carbon because of its tetravalence than you can with other atoms with lower valence. For instance, hydrogen has a valence of 1. So the only way you can have things different when you involve hydrogen is to have different things that it's connected to. But it's always going to be connected to one atom and forming one bond. So very little versatility, really. Carbon, on the other hand, can make, it's always going to make a total of 4, but it can make 4 single bonds, it can make 2 double bonds, it can make a triple bond and a single bond, all of which add up to 4. And that's more diversity right there, just for that reason. But if you consider making 4 individual single bonds, for instance, you can do that with 4 of the same kind of atom, like in methane, 2 of one and 2 of another, 3 of one and 1 of another, or all 4 different. And similarly for the 2 double bonds it could make. So there's a lot more versatility with respect to bonding with other nonmetals to make molecules. When we talked about the periodic table, we mentioned, well, first of all, what are the columns called? Groups. And what's special about the members of any given group? I mean, what is special about a group? Yes, groups, not only that, groups have, or the members of one group have similar chemical properties, one of which is the valence. You know, anything in the same group are going to be the same number of steps from the right edge. So that's why they have the same valence. And so carbon is in this group, obviously. It's not the only tetravalent atom. But what is special about carbon in this group? And don't overthink this. If I were just to ask a little kid. Right, it's on top. Meaning it's the smallest. It's the smallest tetravalent element. And because tetravalence has this versatility with respect to making bonds, that's why it became the basis for compounds that make up living things. That's why we say we're carbon-based life. Slide 4 is just a structural formula of urea. I don't want you to know this structural formula. But the reason it's here is because it's just for historical importance. Last time I was talking about the fact that we called things organic compounds because we falsely believed that they couldn't be produced. They had to be gotten from things that are alive, from organisms. You can't produce them out of inorganic stuff. Well, that's not true. We eventually were successful, and now it's routinely done. But urea is the first synthesized organic compound, meaning humans made it out of inorganic precursor molecules. And so it was a milestone. But urea itself is a breakdown product. If you use proteins as fuels, which you don't usually, you usually use them as building materials, but if you use them as fuels, then you have to get rid of the nitrogens that's in the proteins before you can use them as fuels, and That leads to waste, nitrogenous waste, which urea is, which if it builds up to high levels would be toxic, but we get rid of it as part of the urine. It's also, and this isn't really also important about this chapter, but while we're at it, this is kind of an unusual organic molecule because in almost all organic molecules, the carbon is bonded. If there's carbon and hydrogen, there's carbon bonded directly to hydrogen. It's not the case here, but this is still organic. And so are all of the compounds that we see in slide 5. But more specifically, these are what? What are all of these examples of? They're all hydrocarbons. All of these, just like that couple slides ago, have nothing but carbon and hydrogen. So they are hydrocarbons first, but more specifically, they are organic compounds first, and more specifically hydrocarbons. And there's no limit to the number of hydrocarbons that can be produced, because you can keep adding more and more carbons and hydrogens and configure them in different ways. And therefore, there's different ways that we classify this enormous number of hydrocarbons just to make things easier to deal with. Notice that each one of these compounds has a teal highlighted area, which is just all of the carbons that are connected together. However many carbons there are in an organic compound, we call that the carbon skeleton, because everything else in the molecule, whatever those atoms are connected to that carbon skeleton. All right, now, if you have a hydrocarbon that has only single covalent bonds in it, like these two, ethane and propane, for instance, but there's a lot of examples. But if there aren't any multiple bonds, if there aren't any double or triple bonds, if it's only single, then collectively all of those hydrocarbons as a group are called alkanes. So alkane is not a specific substance, it's a group. Notice though that it ends in A-N-E-S, alkanes. Well, to make things easier, we name the specific alkanes with a name that also ends in A-N-E, like ethane and propane. And by the way, eth and prope and several other prefixes indicate how big the carbon skeleton is. Meth that you made means one, just one carbon and four hydrogens. Eth means two, so ethane has two carbons and only single bonds and made with hydrogen. Prope means three, bute means four, butane. Octane means eight, it's just one component of gasoline, and so on. So this slide overall indicates four fundamentally different ways to categorize hydrocarbons, one of which is just based on the size of the carbon skeleton. Okay, just the chain length, in other words. If we go to the upper right, we can see that we can also classify hydrocarbons, that is, based on whether or not there are double bonds present. So I said that if there aren't any double or triple bonds, they're called alkanes. Well, if there is at least one double bond, it's not an alkane anymore, it's an alkene, which is another group. And things that are alkenes get a name ending in E-N-E to tell you that, like butene, one butene and two butene. These are different things, by the way, because notice that the position of the double bond is different. One butene has the double bond between carbon 1 and 2. Two butene has the double bond between carbon 2 and 3. And so on. So that's another way of classifying them. By the way, if there's a triple bond, at least one, then they aren't alkanes or alkenes. They're alkynes with a Y. And those names will end in Y-N-E instead. And one more way of categorizing these hydrocarbons is on the basis of whether or not the carbon skeleton branches. Now, branching is not possible when you only have one carbon. In fact, it's not possible when you have only two or three either. But as soon as you get four or more, it's possible for it to either be linear or branched. And these, by the way, these two examples, butane and 2-methylpropane, are examples of isomers, which I don't think we've talked about yet, have we? Be careful with isomers. Isomers are not isotopes. And isotopes are two atoms of the same element, but that differ in their number of neutrons, right? We talked about that before. Iso means same. That's why it's also in this word, but this is totally different. Isomers are two molecules that have exactly the same chemical formula, but they're different substances. And by having the same chemical formula, what that means is that they're both made up of exactly the same number and types of atoms, but they're just arranged differently. So if you look at the chemical formula or the structural formula here, you could see what the chemical formula would be. There's four carbons and there's 10 hydrogens, so it would be C4H10 for butane. But so is 2-methylpropane. Isomers have exactly the same chemical formula. This is also C4H10, which is why the chemical formula doesn't necessarily tell you the whole story when you see it. It could be one of several isomers. And by the way, the branching, the number of ways things can branch, explodes when you get to when you keep adding more carbons. The bigger the number of carbons, the more branches you can have. And so this is one of the reasons why there are just limitless number of possible hydrocarbons that can be made. And then the bottom right shows you yet another way to classify these hydrocarbons, which is based on whether or not they have ringed carbon skeletons. All these other ones before them were not rings. In other words, they had tips, either two tips or more, depending on whether it was branched. These are tips of the skeleton. But there aren't tips in a ring because the skeleton wraps back on itself and bonds again. Okay. Six. This cartoon on the right is one molecule, an example of what is called a fat, as you see. And we'll give it different names when we revisit it, when we look at fats in more detail in the next chapter after this first test. But for now, let me say that the reason it's in this chapter, this carbon chapter, is that even though a fat molecule is not a hydrocarbon, because notice these red ones are oxygen atoms. The gray ones are hydrogens, the black ones are carbons. So it's not truly a hydrocarbon, but a fat is made up of this part where it's all connected, which is a glycerol, and then three fatty acid tails. And fatty acid tails do have an oxygen at the end, but other than that, the rest of it, if it were by itself, would be a hydrocarbon. And as I told you a little bit ago today, hydrocarbons make excellent fuels, which is exactly why we, no matter what the nutrient comes in as food, for instance, candy manufacturers love to say no fat on their labels because it's pure sugar. So it is true that there's no fat in it. But we will, if we don't need all of that energy from those calories at the moment, we will store it for later use. We've evolved to save precious calories. They're not so precious anymore. But that sugar will get converted into fat for storage because it's a lot more efficient to store it as fat because these carbon-hydrogen bonds store a lot of the energy. You don't need as much of that stuff to store that amount of energy. It has a higher energy density. I'll just also say, though, that fats are useful for other reasons, including that they provide thermal insulation. You know, it can keep your body either warmer than or cooler than the environment, depending on what the environmental temperature is, because it's insulation. And it also provides padding. You know, like there's a fat pad around each kidney to protect it. We sit on fat and so on. So it's padding material as well. We'll get into more about fats, though, later. I just wanted to mention the hydrocarbon aspect. That brings us to 7. And 7 shows us that there are multiple ways to categorize isomers. Now, these aren't necessarily hydrocarbons. They can be. But isomers in general are substances that have the same chemical formula. And there are actually more than 3 categories of isomers. If you were to take an organic chemistry course, you would learn more. But there's 3 that we'll learn in this course, as we see here. The top of which is structural isomers. Structural isomers differ from each other simply in how the carbon skeleton is arranged, as you see in these examples. Pentane and 2-methylbutane. One of them is not branched, one of them is. So that's pretty straightforward, and I've kind of already talked about that. Geometric isomers is a little bit different from what I've been talking about, though. Notice that the structural isomers at the top don't have any double bonds. However, the example in geometric isomers, those do. And here's where, having played with your molecular modeling kits, makes it easier to understand. You know, when you use a single bond, the wooden stick, you were able to swivel it, right? You can swivel a single bond, so the other things that turn with it aren't kept in place. They can be in any position. But think about your pair of springs, which was a double bond. You can't indefinitely swivel them. You can a little bit, but you can't turn them all the way around, right? They can't swivel because of that double bond. And therefore, that causes what are called geometric isomers. Now, X here refers to anything other than hydrogen. So this, you have 2 carbons double bonded. They're locked in place. They can't swivel here at the double bond. And therefore, if you have 2 X's and 2 H's, there's 2 possibilities for their placement. Both of the X's can be on the same side, or the X's can be on opposite sides. And whichever one it is, it's not going to be able to swivel into the other version. If this was a single bond, you could just twist that to make this. You see what I'm saying? But it can't swivel because of the double bond. So these are 2 separate kinds of substances, 2 isomers. And we distinguish them with the cis and trans notation. Just like in cisgender and transgender, for instance. Cis means same side. Trans means across or opposite side. And so, for instance, you probably in nutritional news heard about trans fats, for instance. That's where another use of that word. All right, and then the third one, the only other category of isomers we'll look at in this course, are the enantiomers. And enantiomers are examples of chiral compounds. Now, have you encountered this word? Have you been taught about chiral compounds in any courses you've taken? Okay, well, chiral means handed. Chiro, as a combining form, means hand, like in chiropractor. Someone who works on you with his or her hands is a chiropractor. Or chiromancer is someone who uses his hands to cast spells. That's why it's got the name. Anyway, chiro or chiral means hand. And that's why hands are shown in this example, along with molecules. But consider your hands before you consider the molecules. They're very similar to each other, right? but they're not the same. If you could safely hack off your hands so that you could move them around in space to play around with them, there's no way you can flip around your right hand and make it into your left hand, because they're not the same. They're mirror images of each other. So there's a right-handed version and a left-handed version. All right. Similarly with chiral molecules, which these two are examples of. They're isomers, just like all of these on this screen, so they have exactly the same atoms. They're both CO2H, as you see. But what makes them chiral is that you have a central carbon, which, remember, is tetravalent, so it has to make four bonds. In this case, it's making four single bonds. If you have that situation of forming of a central carbon forming four single bonds, but more than that, forming with four different types of atoms, which you do here, these are all four different things, then you have a chiral compound, because just like you can't move your hand around to make it into the other, there's no way you could assemble this with your ball and stick kit, pick it up and move it around and just position it differently to make it into the mirror image. You cannot do that. You would have to break bonds and swap two of the atoms to make it the mirror image. So they are distinct molecules, even though they're very similar, obviously. They're not only have the same chemical formula, they have the same shape, just mirror images of each other. But that makes them interact with other things differently, and that's why chirality is important, including in biology, as we see in slide 8. A while back, I introduced you to the notion of signal molecules, right? Chemical signals. What did I say has to be true for a chemical signal to have any effect? Yeah.
Protein has to be able to fit the receptor.
Well, the signal has to be able to fit a receptor, which is a protein. The receptor itself is a protein. And the signal could be anything, including another protein, but sometimes it's not a protein. Anyway, the signal will have no effect unless the cell has the correctly shaped receptor protein to fit it, like a hand in a glove. And even though you might be able to put your right hand, depending on the kind of gloves, into a left glove, it's not an ideal fit, right? So if you have a signal that is chiral, meaning that there's a left-handed version and a right-handed version of the signal, only one of them will actually have any effect in the body. These are drugs that we're seeing here, so exogenous signals, ones that your body doesn't produce but that you can put into your body to have effects. So the pharmaceutical companies could make either version of ibuprofen. It comes in right-handed and left-handed versions, but since the body has only one or the other kind of receptor and not both, it matters which one you make. One will just be totally useless. And you can't always say that it's always the left version that's good or always the right version that's effective. It just depends on the signal, depends on the receptor. In the case of ibuprofen, it happens to be the left-handed version that works. The right-handed version does nothing. But in albuterol, used for asthma, the right-handed version is effective and the left-handed version does nothing. By the way, you notice these R and S designations on the names when you have chiral compounds. R stands for recto, which means right, like in rectangle, right angles. And S stands for sinistro, which means left. By the way, this brings up two ways in which we kind of abuse the left-handers of the world, simply because the majority of people are right-handed. The word sinister literally means left-handed, but we use it to mean, oh, that person can't be trusted because that person's left-handed, not like us. So it's not fair, of course, but that's what sinister really means, left-handed. And S and R are used as one standard when you're talking about chiral compounds. Slide 9 gives you another example. L-DOPA and D-DOPA. Only one of those is effective because it's chiral. These are not drugs. These are L-DOPA is made in your body. So it's an endogenous signal, but it still is chiral. But this is not using S and R, notice. It's using L and D. Just another standard. D stands for dextro, which is right. And L stands for levo, which is left. So the other way that we abuse the left-handers of the world is that it is in the word ambidextrous, which is someone who can use either hand equally well. Well, ambidextrous literally means having two right hands. Because, of course, you can't manipulate things with a left hand, which is, of course, not true. All right. Now to 10. Here we have a couple examples of steroid hormones. There are more steroid hormones than these two, but you've probably heard of these. Estradiol is the main estrogen. And testosterone, I'm sure you've heard of. Well, estrogen and testosterone have drastically different effects, right? Estrogens are feminizing hormones. Testosterone is a masculizing hormone. So in some respects, they're opposites of each other in their effect. But notice that their structural formulae are very similar. They're really not all that different in terms of molecules. There's a good reason why they are so similar as molecules, by the way. Not only these two steroid hormones, but all steroids, whether they're hormones or not, all steroids in an animal's body start out as the same precursor molecule, which is also a steroid, and then they're just modified into the other things. So these started out as the same molecule. And does anyone know what that precursor molecule is in animals that's used to make all the steroids? It is cholesterol. Just one of the reasons why animals cannot live without cholesterol. So if you were to look at cholesterol, and we will later, you'll see that it has this ring structure as well. It's very similar. Which means that these two steroids that were made from cholesterol were produced by making pretty small-scale changes to the original molecule. The only differences here are the ones that are highlighted in blue. That's enough to make a big difference, though. And these things that are highlighted in blue are examples of functional groups that you just barely got introduced to in the lab, but you haven't gotten to explain them yet. All right. Functional groups are not molecules. They're not complete molecules. Functional groups are just small collections of atoms that can be present as part of a much bigger molecule. In other words, functional groups are just hanging off of a bigger molecule somewhere. And the reason they're called functional groups is because if a molecule has that particular collection of atoms hanging off of it, then that will give the overall molecule some function that it wouldn't have without that functional group. Functional groups are really important in biology because they govern the way in which molecules interact with each other, how the organism itself functions, including how these two hormones operate differently. So that's the definition of functional groups, and now we can look at a couple slides to actually go through the functional groups that you're responsible for in this course. Remember what I said already. This is material that's for both the lecture and the lab. You need to know the functional groups in the lab as well. But you should already, because you have to know them for the test, which is coming up before the lab even. Is that true, or do you?
Yeah, that's Tuesday.
Yeah, but when is the lab?
Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, I get my Tuesday, Thursdays, and my Monday, Wednesday. Monday, Wednesday has their lab before the lecture, and so it throws me off. Anyway, I said two slides, and that's because this one table, if you were to look at this in a book, takes up two slides, so it's all one table, starting with 11. And each column here is a different functional group, and we'll go through them one by one. But first, let me show you that every individual functional group is shown as a ball and stick figure, for one, and also as a chemical symbol form in blue highlighting. And so you need to know those as well as the names. You need to know what I'm about to tell you about each of these. But whether you're depicting them as a ball and stick or a chemical symbol, notice that you can see from either of those renditions that these are not complete molecules. Why is that? How can you tell that these are not complete molecules?
Because they have bonds.
Right. They have bonds that aren't actually connected to anything yet. That's why you don't find functional groups on their own. You find them as part of a larger molecule. And you can depict them the way this book does, meaning with a line showing the bond, but then nothing connected to it. But you can also depict them, as many books do, with R on the other side of the bond. And R, if it's used, stands for residue, which means the rest, what's left over. So it's just all the rest of the molecule is what R represents. And by the way, for instance, this first one is hydroxyl group, which is an oxygen bonded to a hydrogen, and the oxygen is also bonded to the rest of the molecule. So you could depict it this way, R-OH, but R can be in any position. For instance, you can also do it as HO-R. Importantly, though, it would be wrong to write R-HO. Why is that? What's wrong with this third one?
Hydrogen only has a valence of 1.
That's right. Hydrogen has a valence of 1, so it can't make two bonds. Right? It can't be bonded to an oxygen and the rest. Oxygen can, though, and indeed has to be, right? Because it has to make two bonds. So if it's making one of its bonds with hydrogen, that has to be a single bond, and therefore it needs one more bond. Okay, so that's wrong, that third one. Let's talk about hydroxyls, though. Hydroxyl groups are found in a lot of molecules in chemistry, but biology as well. And so there's many, many example substances that have hydroxyl groups. But if you consider all of the chemicals that have a hydroxyl, at least one hydroxyl, because you can have multiple ones at the same time within the same molecule, all of the hydroxyl-containing compounds form a group that we call alcohols. So we usually kind of think of one alcohol, the one that's in alcoholic beverages, whether it's beer, wine, or booze. It's all ethanol. You shouldn't be drinking methanol. That's going to kill you. But there's all kinds of other alcohols. All right? An alcohol is simply a compound that has a hydroxyl in it somewhere as a functional group. And just like we name specific alkanes with words that end in A-N-E, also the alcohols are named with a name that ends in O-L, like ethanol. Ethanol, in fact, gets its name because it's like ethane, except instead of having just a hydrogen here, which ethane would, it has an OH as well. So it's ethane-like alcohol, ethanol. And similar to the other ones, cholesterol is another example. Cholesterol is an alcohol because it has a hydroxyl group. As far as how that hydroxyl group affects the chemistry, well, think about water molecules that we spent a lot of time on. They're polar, right? They're polar because oxygen has a much higher electronegativity than hydrogen. Well, you have the same two atoms in a hydroxyl, oxygen and hydrogen, sharing electrons, but not equally. So alcohols are at least partially polar. Not necessarily as much as water, because it can be a big molecule with only a hydroxyl being a minor part of it, but it's still that affects the polarity of the molecule. All right, next is the carbonyl group. And notice that it is formed as one carbon that is double bonded to an oxygen. And then there are, of course, two other bonds that same carbon has to make to satisfy its valence. So there's two things hanging off here, not just one. Two R's, in other words. And therefore, there's not just one category of carbonyl-containing compounds. There's two, depending on what those R's are. All right, now one possibility is that the carbonyl, the carbon of the carbonyl, the C of the C double bond O, is at a tip of a carbon skeleton, which it is in this bottom example in the middle here, propanol. All right? Now, it could be on either side, or if it's branched, any of the tips. If it's at a tip of the carbon skeleton, however many tips there are, that's one possibility. And in that case, the other R is just a hydrogen to fill up the bond. The other possibility, though, is that the carbon of the carbonyl is not at a tip. So on either side of that carbon, there are other carbons. It's in the middle of a carbon skeleton, or not necessarily at the middle, but not at a tip, just like here. You see the difference? And so for these two major possibilities, we form two major groups of carbonyl-containing compounds. If the carbonyl is found at a tip of the skeleton, then it's a member of compounds that we call aldehydes. And we usually give them names that end in A-L to say that they're aldehydes. Propanol, not propanol. Propanol is an alcohol. Propanol is an aldehyde. All right. If the carbon of the carbonyl group is not at a tip of the skeleton, anywhere else other than a tip, then it's not an aldehyde, it's a ketone. And those specific substances get names ending in O-N-E, like acetone, shown here. All right. Now, hopefully this will help you. I used to confuse which one was which all the time. But then one day it dawned on me that the word aldehyde starts with an A, which is at one tip of the alphabet. And the word ketone starts with a K that's not at a tip of the alphabet. So use that if it helps you. But those are the two categories. And we'll see that these are important in carbohydrates when we finally get to studying carbohydrates in greater detail. Okay, next is carboxyl. Now this one is potentially confusing. Let's first look at the structure. It's a carbon double bonded to an oxygen, and that same carbon is also bonded to an OH, plus the fourth bond of that carbon connects to the rest, the R. The reason I said it's potentially confusing is that when you look at it, it looks like it is a carbonyl with a hydroxyl connected to it. And actually it is. But we don't consider this to be a carbonyl group or a hydroxyl group. If it has this particular arrangement, then the whole thing is one functional group called a carboxyl. Notice, though, that the word carboxyl is really just a portmanteau or a combination of two words, carbonyl and hydroxyl. become carboxyl, to remind you that they are. But they're not two, it's really not two different function groups, it's one. And the category of compounds that have carboxyl in them are called either organic acids or carboxylic acids. Carboxylic is really descriptive, right? Carboxylic means carboxyl containing. Carboxylic acids. Biologically, these can't be overstated how important these are, because I've told you already several times that proteins do all the important jobs in cells. Proteins are polymers, large molecules that are made out of subunits called amino acids. Each amino acid has a carboxyl in it. So you can't have any proteins, and therefore no life, without carboxylic acids. All right, 12 is just a continuation of this same table. So the next functional group up is the amino group. This one contains nitrogen. There is no carbon in the amino group. It's a nitrogen singly bonded to two different hydrogens, and then the third nitrogen bond is formed with the residue. Well, the word amino, or related words like amine, or anytime you basically have A-M-I-N in a chemical word, that's telling you that it contains nitrogen. All right? In fact, that's the class of compounds. Things that have amino groups are called amines. But also amono, that's the same thing. A-M-O-N is also nitrogen-containing, like ammonia. Well, in the previous one, which was the carboxyl group, I said it's important because it's contained in every amino acid that makes up proteins. Well, also, every amino acid has an amino group, which is why they're called amino acids. This is just one amino acid. We'll talk about the other ones in a different chapter, but every amino acid has a carboxyl group. Notice that this is carboxyl, one we just went over, and an amino group. So it's both a carboxylic acid, that's the acid part of amino acid, plus it has an amino group, so it's an amino acid. So they're just as important as carboxyl groups, because you can't have proteins without them. Alrighty, next is sulfhydryl. What is the sulfhydryl most similar to that we studied? It's an SH. Yes, very similar to hydroxyl, not just because it has two atoms. Why is it also similar? Well, when you did your modeling, what did you didn't have any sulfurs, right? What did you have to use for a sulfur?
Oxygen.
Right. You didn't just make a random choice. You chose oxygen for what reason? Has the same valence, in the same group. So SH is very similar to OH. But of course, it's not identical. It's a sulfhydryl, not a hydroxyl. Well, what did I just tell you we call compounds that have hydroxyl?
Alcohols.
Things that have sulfhydryls instead of hydroxyls are kind of like alcohols, because SH is kind of like OH, but we instead call these thiols. Notice the OL ending. THI means sulfur. So thiol literally means sulfur alcohol. It's not truly an alcohol, but it's kind of like an alcohol using sulfur instead of oxygen. And biologically, these are important, once again involving proteins, because as we'll study later, some proteins, some amino acids in the big overall polymer called a protein, some of the amino acids that are part of that are sulfur containing. And when a protein folds up into a certain shape, two sulfurs from two different sulfhydryls can come close together, and they will lose, each one will lose their hydrogen, and the two sulfurs will covalently bond together, and that really stabilizes the shape of the protein. You have this, a lot of this in your hair, for instance, which is gives it its strength, but it's also why if you burn hair, it smells like sulfur. All right, now to phosphate. Phosphate is the most complex of the ones that we have to learn. This is not an exhaustive list of functional groups. If you were in an organic chemistry class, you would learn others as well, but these are the ones we're studying. Phosphate, though, is the most complex in terms of number of atoms involved. Notice that it is a phosphorus atom bonded to four different oxygens, and one of those oxygens is then connected to the rest of the molecule. All right? Now, phosphates are important for multiple different reasons, all of which are completely indispensable to life. For one thing, phosphates are part of molecules that we'll study later called phospholipids. Hence phospholipids, because they have a phosphate in them. There can be no cells. No cells would have formed, and therefore none of us would be here, without phospholipids, for reasons I'll explain later, but that's one indispensably important reason why phosphates are important. Also, though, phosphates are often either stuck onto or taken off of other molecules, like proteins, typically. And this is a way to act as a switch, more or less. You can either phosphorylate or dephosphorylate proteins to either give them a function or take that function away. Enzymes, for instance, can be phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. That's useful because if you want to turn an enzyme off, you could destroy it. That would work, but if you then, the next moment, need it again, you'd have to rebuild it. It's much better to have a switch. You can just switch back and forth. And phosphorylation and dephosphorylation does that. And another reason that we can't exist without them is that every individual building block of nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, both, contain phosphate. So there's millions of nucleotides making up one DNA. That means there's millions of phosphates in that one DNA. Methyl is the final one. And these you find all over the place. If you look at structural formulae, this is the one that you'll find more of than anything else, typically. It makes sense because it's a carbon with three hydrogens, single bonded, of course, and then the fourth bond is made to the rest of the molecule. The reason it makes sense that they're so plentiful is that you'll see them on every tip of a carbon skeleton. If a carbon is at the tip and it's forming a single bond with the other carbons, then it has three bonds to fill, right? Hydrogens are the easiest thing to fill those bonds with. So you see methyls at tips of skeletons all the time. Biologically, they're important for a similar reason that phosphate was important, not because of the DNA or because of the phospholipids, but because methylation and demethylation can also be used as switches. Specifically for DNA. We haven't talked about how DNA is used yet as a code, but genes are just pieces of DNA that are used as codes, and you can either make that gene available or like putting genes are kind of like manuals in a library. You can make it available or you can hide it from the library patrons by either methylating it or demethylating it. All right, so that's the list for this course. 13, I think, is the last slide. And this is a molecule that we are going to talk a lot more about. Actually, it's two molecules, one on each side here. ATP, though, you've probably heard about. Do you know what this stands for? Right, adenosine, which is spelled thus. Adenosine triphosphate. Oh, by the way, this is yet another reason why phosphate is so important. Notice there, well, I shouldn't say notice because I haven't told you this yet. But a P with a circle around it, don't confuse that with a phosphorus atom. P by itself means phosphorus. P with a circle around it is shorthand for a phosphate group, which has those four oxygens as well as the phosphorus. All right, so it's just a quicker way of drawing a phosphate group. Well, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, has three phosphates connected to it, and that allows it to contain a lot of energy for temporary storage, very temporary. As we'll learn the particulars of later, when we extract energy from our food by combusting it, like I was talking about, getting energy out of those CH bonds, we put that energy into temporary storage in the form of ATP molecules that we build. And then they're not hang around very long because next moment we need that energy to use it for something, and we break the bonds between phosphate molecules to get the energy back out. And so ATP, when it's used for energy, gets dephosphorylated. One of the phosphates gets taken off of it, and that leaves an inorganic phosphate, which is why you have an I here. It's inorganic because think about what a phosphate group is. It doesn't have any carbon in it, right? So if it's on its own, it's not organic. But then the rest of this is adenosine diphosphate because it only has two phosphates connected to it as well. And then we can reverse this process. If we get energy from food again, we can stick it back on and store that energy as ATP again. It's always going back and forth. But that's the particulars of that is a Unit 3 thing, so we'll get to that eventually. Yeah, we are done. So, if you have questions about the tests, you can ask me. But feel free to leave, and if you don't have questions, we're done. But anyone want to know anything about the test or anything, actually? Yeah, if you look at the page that has the synchronized slideshows, which are the most important things to study, notice that table has color coding. Each color is a different unit. Each unit is one test's worth of material. So everything until right now that we've covered is on test one. And we won't start unit two until the day after the test. Because that's another thing. You won't necessarily take the entire time of next period to finish the exam. You're depends on how well you know it on as to how quickly you get done. But that's the only thing we do on test days is the test. So unit two will start the following day. That's correct. That's why I call them lecture examinations. Every bit of the material is somewhere in those online slideshows. If I don't mention it on the online slideshows, it's not going to be part of a question on my test. I promise that. All right? But just take a long... Hopefully you have been doing this already because it's already too late to start and to do well. You should have been doing this all along. All right, so just don't forget your Scantron so that you don't have to bum them from your classmates. I won't have any. Oh, just at the bookstore, the campus bookstore, yeah. Just tell them you need green Scantrons.